You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 63 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or swing by our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. In this episode, we're going to dive into the topic of bots, botnets, and how they were used during the Brexit referendum in relation to regular users. So what's the difference between a human user and a bot? What were they sharing during Brexit? What impact might they have played? We're going to dig into all of that with Dr. Marco Bastos. He is a senior lecturer in media and communications at City, University of London. And together with Dr. Dan Murcha, has been really researching the Twitter sphere around the Brexit referendum and uncovered a network of botnets. So most of the work we're going to be discussing comes from an article entitled The Brexit Botnet and User-Generated Hyperpartisan News, which is published in Social Science Computer Review. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out. And in a more recent piece, kind of reflecting on their experience working with these botnets, Dr. Bastos and Dr. Murcha have written a follow-up piece entitled The Public Accountability of Social Platforms, Lessons from a Study on Bots and Trolls in the Brexit Campaign. And that article is more a reflection around the challenges and lessons learned in the original study looking at Brexit botnets and the infrastructural and ethical challenges associated with doing this type of research. So this is very much an academic-oriented episode, as will our next episode, which will be with Dr. Murcha and Dr. Sean Walker from Arizona State University, talking about the Occupy movement, transnational protests, and social media challenges and opportunities for research. So Dr. Bastos was in Copenhagen for a conference that will also be talking about next episode and came straight from a flight with a bit of a cold. So thanks to him for coming on and fighting through it. And without further ado, let me cut to that interview. My guest again is Dr. Marco Bastos. He is a senior lecturer in media and communications at City, University of London. Dr. Bastos, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks for having me here.
So I'd like to start out by discussing your work on Twitter botnets during the Brexit referendum. And before we dive into the specifics of that study, can you give us a broad introduction to the project looking at Twitter and Brexit? What were you trying to investigate and why focus on bots specifically?
Well, we actually weren't looking for bots at all. We were looking at the ideological variance in the data. We wanted to know if the users were tweeting more populist or nationalist messages compared to globalist or messages of economic nature. And it just happened that a large chunk of users disappeared from the data, and that kind of got us thinking, what's going on here? And it kept happening. So we started taking a look at the data going back to a couple of weeks before the vote, and we found that those users looked a lot like bots. And we run the tests, we develop a classifier, and we figure out that in all likelihood we're dealing with a large network of bots.
And when you say disappeared from Twitter, it's that you were collecting this data and then you found out later that those accounts were no longer on the platform?
That's right. So after we collect the data, because of the constraints of the project, we had to follow those users basically every couple of weeks. So say every second or third week, we will do something we call a user lookup, which is basically asking Twitter how this user is doing. So how many messages he or she tweeted since last time we made the check, and the followership, have those users got more followers in the meantime. And during this process, we start getting a lot of negative responses from Twitter saying, sorry, user does not exist, user not found, or account blocked, or account locked due to, I don't know, API violations, things like that. And I've done experiments and studies like that many times. And it was the first time that the number of accounts that disappeared became so high to the point of that it literally take a dent in our data set. So we didn't know actually for a very long period of time if Twitter Inc., so the company had killed these accounts, if the bot masters have decided to retire them, if we actually had no idea who killed the accounts. We just knew that they disappeared. But during the parliamentary hearings in Britain, Twitter, they contact me. They ask for the ID of the account. So I sent them the user IDs. They did a check on these accounts, and they actually made a statement and saying that, they killed them.
Mm. And when you're saying user lookup, or, you know, in terms of communicating with Twitter, is this something you're doing strictly through APIs, or are you actually having a contact person at Twitter on a sort of rolling basis?
Up to this point, everything was basically REST, search, and streaming API. So it was a through the force of APIs, if you will, in the sense that we kept going back and forth to APIs. After this study came out, Twitter invited us to come into their headquarters in London, which, of course, was an interesting conversation that we had. And Twitter is supporting our research, so this is also very good. We are part of the group of researchers that they actually gifted a portion. All money they received from RT, Russia Today, and Sputnik.
Aha, so that money that was found to be sort of kind of disinformation, you got a slice of that.
Right, you're looking at the person who got a slice of that.
Awesome. So I think it's fascinating that you're looking at these kind of broader Twitter conversations about populism or nationalism and globalism during Brexit. You find a bunch of bots. I wanted to ask, before getting more specific into that, how exactly you define a bot and a botnet?
Well, defining a bot is anything but an exact science. So we have a number of metrics, if you will. You could call it types of behavior. We call it activity patterns. So really and truly what they mean is that because these accounts are scripted, they are automated, so someone basically programmed them, they are fairly predictable in terms of how they're going to tweet, how many tweets they're going to send, what time of the day. So there are basically patterns that we can identify and then make an approximation to call them a bot, or at least a bot-like account. In our specific case, before we got to the metrics that are usually predictive of a bot-like activity, we got lucky enough that first, they disappear more or less at the same time. And second, they were part of what in social networks we call a large component. So they were kind of tweeting each other. There was some sort of concerted effort going on there in terms of the messages they're trying to push and the extent to which those accounts were connected. So first we had a graph, a chunk of accounts that were somehow connected. They disappear. And then you take a look at them. In our case, the best metrics that were predictive of bot-like activity were RT, so retweet transitivity, meaning how many messages a given account retweet in comparison to how many of their messages get retweeted. So as you can imagine, because they are scripted, the distribution is extraordinarily skewed.
And in that case, in terms of how many retweets they would get, I'm curious as to, you know, how many people are following these bots? I mean, you mentioned that there's kind of a network aspect to it where I guess bots follow other bots. But in terms of this tweet versus being retweeted ratio, I mean, are bots getting retweeted a lot by other people? Are they having a large followership? I mean, what's kind of the dynamic of a general Brexit bot?
So it's a whole another world out there, those bots and what they're doing. So there are at least three types of different strategies when it comes to developing and deploying bots. One of those is what Facebook calls false amplification. So you can have a range of bots just retweeting real-world users. So nobody is going to read those bots. They're just there to inflate the number of, say, retweets, or in Facebook's case, that would be a share or a like. So that just gives you a false artificial impression of how popular a message is. These accounts are not there really to engage in any conversation. They are just to manipulate the number of likes, shares, retweets, so on and so forth. But we also found the accounts that more than retweeting a relatively small sample of users, they would almost curate some sort of portion of the Brexit debate. So even though they were bots, again, automatically retweeting a given set of messages, they were read apparently by real-world users because real-world users would retweet them. So you have also bot accounts that are relatively effective at making indent and gaining some sort of foothold in the real-world political discussion out there. To be fair, most of the accounts that I like on Twitter are also bots. So I find them funny because you can actually script something that's particularly funny. So the automation here is not so much the problem, but how you deploy them. And there's this gray zone between what is organic social media conversation from, of course, what is completely artificial and manipulated political conversation.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I want to unpack a bit of what you just said. But first, I think it's kind of interesting to put in perspective. You found just about 13,500 bots that were on Twitter during the referendum out of about how many users? Do you remember?
So we have many different snapshots of the data. We end up looking just at 4 weeks, 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after. I don't remember the exact figure. Off the top of my head, I think we were looking at something like 600,000 users, something like this, unique users. But don't quote me on that. I think that might be just the organic users.
Mm. And that's also something that's interesting. Because you had this snapshot of 2 weeks before and then 2 weeks after the referendum, you find something super interesting, I think, which is after the referendum, this bot activity basically just drops, right?
Yeah, except for... There was one or two messages that were quite popular that the botnet kind of worked out to push it and make it popular, and they did. And there was, I think, a week after the vote. It was something along the lines of Brexit is the best thing that Britain has ever done, something like this, which came against the backdrop of shock and criticism after the result of the vote. So it was, if anything, potentially a reaction to critiques that were starting to fly against the result of the referendum. But it was after this message, there isn't much because the accounts start being killed or they're pulled off or deleted. According to the best of our knowledge, anyway, according to what Twitter has said, they killed them in two steps, basically. There's one that were a good chunk of them were taken down, I think, 2 weeks after the vote. But that was the figure, if I remember correctly. And they took another chunk of these accounts down the road later on.
And that brings me to this question that you talk about a lot in the paper, which is recycled bots and the bot life cycle. Could you break down those concepts and sort of what they mean, why they're relevant?
Right. So because so many accounts have disappeared in this relatively short period of time, we start looking at everything that has changed since they tweeted any Brexit-related message. One of the things we found was that some of these accounts were active still, so they were not banned, they were not deleted, Twitter did not kill them, but they were operating with a different username. That was quite common. We saw, I think, 20 to 30,000 accounts. It was a considerable number of accounts that have done that. So we call these accounts recycled accounts because it appeared that they were repurposed or they were no longer operating according to the same constraints or using the same screen name that they were using during the Brexit vote, which was the case. But the more we look at this set of accounts, the more they appear to be much more like real-world accounts than bots. So they did not display the quite clear automation characteristics that we found in the botnet. If anything, they looked more like real-world users.
Mm. And is that because, I know I've seen this a bit in the literature on cyber attacks, for example, that it's harder for Twitter to detect a bot if it's been aged or if it's been started at a, you know, maybe 2010 is a much harder bot to identify than one that's been created yesterday. So do you think it's that these bot masters are taking the same usernames, maybe switching their identities and then repurposing them to other contexts, elections or otherwise?
It's quite possible. One of the things we learned down this somewhat dark road of Brexit botnets was that a good chunk of normal users would simply stop using Twitter altogether, and their accounts would be hijacked down the road by, let's call them, rogue users or rogue organizations. So some of these accounts might be old in the sense that they were created a long time ago, but they did not tweet much. And indeed, one of the metrics that was predictive of bot activity in our data was account age. So it's a very simple calculation. The longer you are in the platform, the more time you have put to that specific account, the less likely it is that you're dealing with an account here that is not just automated, but that it's publishing low-quality content. So if the accounts are old, yes, it gets harder to spot them. I took a brief look at the complete set of Iranian accounts that Twitter distributed, I think like 2 weeks ago, so it's very recent. Then now they released all the data from both the IRA, the Russian Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, but also the set of accounts that were in All Include operated from Iran. And there was a number of accounts there that, interesting, were from 2010 and 11. Those are very hard to spot because they really look very authentic.
Yeah, and just a side note, I've seen on LinkedIn, Iranians, they actually have a net. So it, I don't know to what extent it's a bot or not type of issue, but they actually have accounts that are leader accounts and support accounts. So they'll have an army of accounts that will, their only purpose is to follow the leader to make their, you know, connections look larger. So maybe there's some sort of dynamic at play across platforms. But I think what I'd like to ask you about is the actual content of what these bots were producing. And I think one of the interesting findings of your study is that, you know, the kind of worst case scenario of this mass spread of disinformation didn't seem to be being pushed out by these bots. So what actually were these bots doing in the Brexit debate?
So we found messages both pro-leave and pro-campaign in the data set, in the data set of messages tweeted by bots. So it wasn't just pro-Brexit messages, although they were, there's no doubt, overwhelmingly pro-Brexit. But it appears that automation is now some sort of political campaigning wildcard out there. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that got out of the box and there is no way of putting back in. So we'll be surprised if it's just one side of the campaign using it. It seems to be a widespread technique available now. Having said that, again, it was at least in the data that we have had the chance to look at, was overwhelmingly pro-leave or pro-Brexit, if you will. Sorry, was that your question? No, that's more than your question.
Yeah, in terms of just the general content that these bots were spewing, so they were both, you know, pro-leave and pro-remain. But what exactly were they saying? Were they retweeting hyperlinks from news stories? Were they retweeting other users? Were they, you know, just being sort of humorous or sarcastic? I mean, what was your general impression from what these bots at a level of content were tweeting?
So my expectation is that I would find at least a considerable amount of what is called still fake news. So not just false information, but deliberate false information, diverging the ludicrous, so absurd it is. And no, we didn't find any of it that I can remember right now. I'm sure there must have been a one or two articles here, but the lion's share of information that was problematic and that got shared by these accounts was what we were calling hyperpartisan. So they were extraordinarily polarized and super partisan messages. But they were coming from real world sources, and there will be all sorts of techniques to edit and add another layer of bias, if you will, and to just tilt the balance from what was previously a mainstream media report, just by changing the context or, you know, introducing the new variable in the headline. But those appear to come either from real world users who are, again, highly partisan in their tweeting activity, or from mainstream media that would be repurposed and presented out of context. So the tone of the conversation was extraordinarily partisan. That we can tell for sure. Mm.
And I mean, I have to ask specifically about this context being not just a, you know, large scale referendum on a very important topic, but also the British media landscape. So when you're saying that they were retweeting or reappropriating mainstream news sources, I mean, to what extent do you think that the British media environment played into that hyperpartisanship because you have such a strong tabloid press and a such commercial market?
Right. So that's the part that Britain really is the unique case in Europe, because I don't think you find a country in Europe with a tabloid market that is so healthy, large, and powerful as you find in Britain. So to be honest, a good chunk of the, again, partisan messages and hyper-partisan messages we found pushed by the botnet, they were not all that different from relatively common messages you would find in, you know, in a regular tabloid in Britain. Mm. They were just potentially not as well-crafted, well-written. There was not as much editorial editing going on there. But the bottom line was very similar. It was basically, you know, built over fears of immigration. And the coordinates, the political coordinates those messages were operating were very, very similar, if not identical. That makes it very interesting, of course. But the tabloids, the usual tabloids in Britain, were not that big of a source in for this specific subset of bots. So again, the messages were coming either from mainstream media that were edited by users, or they were completely generated by users. So what we're talking about here is a scenario in which users become some sort of a source and destination of the information. They both generate and they consume this information.
Hmm. I want to switch over and discuss a little bit, one specific method question, because I know you're, very skilled in computational social science. And one of the interesting aspects I thought was how you were reverse engineering these information cascades produced by the bots, because I know from pulling some tweets that you can kind of see how many times a tweet has been retweeted, but it's hard to kind of chain that together into getting a sense of how far actually does a tweet go in the Twitter sphere. So can you describe that process of how exactly you reverse engineered those information cascades to get a sense of the impact of these botnets?
Yeah, so the retweet cascades were not, to my knowledge, were not explored up to that point. We have explored, or there is literature exploring, the cascade of information on Twitter based on HTTP links, hashtags, lists. But we haven't done yet, up to that point, we hadn't done yet an investigation into cascades based on what is obviously the main force of the main dispositive, if you will, of cascade triggering on Twitter, which is the retweet button. And the reason we hadn't done that up to that point was because Twitter doesn't really make it that easy. You know, Twitter makes your life actually quite easy as a researcher, but when it comes to rebuilding the cascade, it doesn't, because it doesn't really keep track of intermediary steps. So if you tweet a message and it gets retweeted by a friend of yours, who is also my friend, and I retweeted this friend we have in common, what I get from information is that I retweeted you. We don't get this friend we have in common. It kind of disappears from the chain. So that is, of course, problematic and difficult to figure out, to work around this problem. The way I worked at that, because I had, I believe, comprehensive data, including the data from our imaginary here, in the example I gave a colleague or friend we have in common, I could use the timestamp and the identity that I could spot across those three messages and put them together, could collate them as a cascade. So I knew, for instance, that the retweet that I tweeted came from you. That Twitter tells me that you were the source of the information. And everybody who retweeted you, we will also have this information. So this friend we have in common also retweeted you. So we'll have that information as well. So really and truly, it's just a matter of putting all the data together and ordering by the timestamp, because messages are, you have the timestamp, you know when they were tweeted. But the way I'm saying it sounds a lot easier than it actually is. It's quite cumbersome, remember, because messages, they get truncated and there are all sorts of issues that I had to work around. But basically, that is the idea. Find the seed message, or patient zero, in this case, was your message, and then work your way back to everybody, everything else that happened after it.
Interesting. And as a general idea, how many, and of course there's no single answer, but as just a imaginary mean, for example, what would be a kind of number of how many times something would be cascaded, or how many iterations of people are we talking about?
So you're talking about for real world users or for bots? You're talking how many messages they got retweeted or how far they would go?
I guess how many iterations of the chain of cascades was there be? Is there a difference between real users and bots?
Oh, yeah, there was a big difference between real. That was indeed the entire reason why we did that. So the question I would get all the time from government officials was, how dangerous are those tubes, basically? I mean, do you really have to be worried about it? Or, this is just about, selling followers and retweets to celebrities and politicians who want to, look more important than they are, in which case, of course, if you are government, you couldn't care less because it's completely irrelevant. But if they really manage to change the tone of the political debate, that's something that, of course, the government would be concerned about. And the only way to do that effectively was to actually let's check how far a few messages both created by bots and joined, if you will, were triggered by bots, would go compared to real-world users. And they didn't. They were very good at triggering retweet cascades in extraordinarily short periods of time, as you'd expect, because obviously they are scripted, so that's what they do. They just start.
Their reaction is instantaneous.
Right. If not instantaneous, extraordinarily fast. A couple of seconds compared to successful retweet cascades from real-world users, who often takes days, weeks to just keep going. As I'm sure you can imagine by your own Twitter activity, you can see sometimes messages you wrote get retweeted several days after they were first created. Bots would trigger the cascade very, very fast. But it wouldn't go that far. That was the interesting thing. I remember, I have this number in my mind. The chances are it's completely inaccurate. But I remember that they dying at the iteration 600-something. I just have this image in my mind that they couldn't push much farther than that, than 600 retweets, at least for a short period of time. And real-world users, they could engage into retweet cascades that would go potentially well over the thousands and thousands of messages.
So would you say then, and I'm thinking about the different algorithms between Facebook and Twitter, where Facebook, you maybe don't need as much engagement, but that signal of relevance can keep a post alive with a little bit of algorithmic underpinning to it. So would you say then on Twitter that the botnets, they may provide a flash of, you know, a bunch of iterations in a retweet cascade, but it's short-lived, whereas users, you may not need as much activity, but they can sustain a message longer in the Twitter sphere. Like, are botnets basically something that can burn bright and really blast into the feeds of users, but not necessarily be sustainable over a few days or a week?
Well, again, it depends on what is the rationale and the objectives of deploying a bot. If it is exclusively to boost the potential impact and reach of a message, I do think that their powers are relatively limited. But as you mentioned, what happens very often in cybersec, in fact, interestingly, one of the accounts we identified as bots, that it turned out wasn't a bot, at least true that we know were false positives. One of them was the troll master Milo Yiannopoulos account at Nero. And that account was incredibly retweeted by a large chunk of the bots we're monitoring. And they, as we know, disappeared at the same time, most of them. All of that, actually. We note that Nero disappeared for different reasons. They managed to infringe on the very generous terms of service of the platform, and it got kicked out. But anyway, it was definitely part of this network of bots. In that case, it appears that it's unclear whether Nero was entirely organic account creation. He had tweeted almost 200,000 tweets so that by the time that the account was retired, or if there was some automation. But what we know is there's a good chunk of accounts that were there just to basically create this sense of repercussion coming out of the whatever Nero was saying back then. So whatever he tweeted, he would get out of the bat. There's just a couple thousand retweets for anything that was obviously completely fabricated for what we can tell. So in that sense, it's not ineffective because it's creating an impression of importance, I guess, or a reach that everybody will get to see if they see the message, whether they retweet or not. So the exposure of this operation is potentially very, very high because you don't have to engage with the content. If the content even crosses your eyes, you will see that metric because it has been artificially inflated. Now, if you are interested in actually boosting a given message, then again, yes, I think it's much harder, at least based on what we saw.
Mm. Yeah, I could imagine Milo Yiannopoulos being a sort of master of manipulation in that sense, but maybe not being so impactful overall. A few more questions for you. In a follow-up piece to that article that I'll also link to the show notes, you discuss at length the ethical considerations in publishing usernames of some of these bots in the paper. And I mean, if these are automated accounts, maybe a few false positives here and there, why should researchers grapple with ethical considerations in reporting about bots?
Right. So accounts that are automated, you wouldn't expect them to be eligible to the same, of course, the same guarantees that we reserve to real-world users. But the reality is bot detection is, again, it's almost more art than science. Pretty much any algorithm that identifies bots, that at least any algorithm I have looked into, will give you a confidence interval of, you know, say only 70% of them will be relatively accurate detection, and the other third will be probably false negatives or false positives. So you have to consider the scenario in which, as confident as you might be within the constraints of your research, that some of these accounts are not bots or were only automated to a certain or limited extent. Having said that, I believe that if the account is definitely a bot, then I mean there's not much to consider here. They're bots, period. And that comes, of course, on top of the fact that those messages were released public. So those accounts were public. They operate publicly. Mm-hmm. The part that gets more complicated is that not all accounts that engage in a public debate are fully aware of how public their activity is. I don't know if that makes sense. But you can think of regular users who engaged in the Brexit debate without knowing that their message suddenly was not just very popular, but that was now being studied by researchers and was used potentially as a benchmark or as a metric to identify, you know, parts of the users who are tweeting X, Y, or Z. So the fact that it is public, it doesn't mean that users have a complete understanding of the publicness of the platform. It doesn't make any sense to you?
It makes sense. And I want to ask, drill a bit deeper and say, is it that even though you're studying bots, and we talked earlier about how you study them via these graph networks, that you need real users in order to serve as almost a proxy for bot activity, if that makes sense. So if you're studying a network of bots, there's real users in the equation. And then when you're reporting about bots and maybe showing graphs of that, then real users, anonymized or not, depending on how you decide to do it, they're included in the study. And is that the ethical part?
Well, there's also that. So the steps we took in the original study was because we're interested in exactly what we discussed before. So how did those bots operate? What kind of operation we could identify? So we had to look at the messages that were popular that they tweeted and which messages were tweeted. So just bot from bot to bot, you know, which makes, of course, some sort of a very strange conversation on Twitter because, you know, bots talking to bots.
It's like these two Alexas talking to each other.
Exactly, on a loop. So imagine that. Who wants to see this? But it happened quite often. And, of course, users retweeting bots, which, as I mentioned, it happens more than you would think. So there's all sorts of constraints there in terms of who we're going to identify here. What we did is basically just name the accounts real-world users, if you will, or just users or versus bots. So that just would potentially keep their usernames out of the conversation. And we only reported on messages that were quite popular. So they had, I think, over a couple thousand retweets. So at this point, you know, you can only expect that people know their messages are very popular. But as far as using real users as a baseline for activity, that is inevitable. And the part that I find more interesting about this debate about bots and automation that it got kind of sidelined is that automation is not bad per se. You see, it's one of the things I find most interesting about Twitter. And I remember using if this, then that, and, you know, automating portions of my Twitter account. As I mentioned back in the beginning, I do follow a few automated accounts that I find very funny. The automation is not a problem. It's just that when Brexit happened and then the 2016 U.S. election happened immediately following, just a couple of months after, automation was suspected as one of the key strategies to manipulate the political scenario. I'm not convinced that that is the problem. In fact, if anything, I think the most problematic accounts are the ones that both rely on automation at specific points in time to either steamroll the discourse or to just give a false sense of amplification to their messages, but that involves human curation as well. So they are much more skilled at keeping an eye on what matters. They can actually pivot and transition from one debate to another because basically there's a person there. These are the accounts that are very, very, potentially very difficult to spot and that are, in all likelihood, connecting the dots in any disinformation campaign out there.
Yeah, I think that's where those cascades are particularly important. I wanted to ask you about the steps that social media companies have taken recently to remove fake and automated accounts. I mean, Facebook has done it, but I think Twitter in particular has had this sort of bot crackdown or bot purge. Do you think these initiatives will curb the influence of bots and botnets in future elections? Or what's your general take on these purging of automated, fake, duplicate accounts, whatever we want to call them?
I'm following Twitter's purge of accounts, and it did take a toll in their in the stock market and the value of the other company, because people were not expecting them to lose so many accounts. I expect this will be positive to the company down the road, because before Brexit, I remember I don't use Twitter or Facebook for that matter that intensively. I do use these platforms, I mostly study them. But my colleagues who use them, obsessively, they start complaining about bots before 2016. By 2014 and 15, they said Twitter is basically just bots at this point. And evidently, at some point, we start that those issues start popping out and appearing in our research. So it's not a new problem, and it's not something that Twitter hasn't known for a long period of time. But again, what makes a bot problematic? Where do you draw the line? Potentially, of course, if they are becoming instruments of political interference and disinformation campaigns, then of course that's a very clear line, and then you gotta kill this account. But why are you gonna kill, Vatican's account that just keeps tweeting Christian and Catholic devotion tips, or the Web Archive that tweets every day a photo from that date that was taken from the Web Archive? There's all sorts of accounts there that is very difficult to purge, and there's no reason really to kill them. I think it's again, if you've managed to find a clear line where the accounts have crossed, and I have very little doubt that the Brexit botnet is a clear account, then I welcome the initiative of retiring these accounts. Mostly because I don't think they add anything to the debate. If anything, I think they are actually eating a little bit of what made those platforms so interesting to get started with. And the debate not only became too polarized, but it ceased to become a debate. It becomes some sort of a information dump. You just go there and dump information that you want people to hear with very little interaction for that matter. So that's very good. The problem, of course, is Facebook, as usual, because we don't know anything about Facebook. We don't know the number of accounts that are potentially false on Facebook, and we don't know basically anything. Twitter, as far as we can tell, they are doing what we hope they will do to keep up with what they call health conversations, right? A healthy public space, if you will.
Yeah, I think in 2 points I want to follow up from that is that, I think you're right in that it will be positive in the future. As we're recording today, Twitter just released its latest quarterly report. It had a drop of 9 million accounts, but still had more ad revenue than ever before. And one of the theories is that because they're purging accounts, there's a more natural or healthy conversation that is encouraging advertisers to invest there. So even though they lost users, their stock price did go up with that sort of bad news, but good news on the advertising side. In terms of what Facebook is doing, we were both at Facebook a few months ago, and you were presenting something on the kind of cutting edge research of what's going on in the space of social media. And so I wanted to ask you about that work and the work you're doing in the future. Do you mind giving us a bit of a teaser as to what we can look out for coming out?
Well, assuming Facebook is not going to sue me, well, and sue us, basically, on the NDAs we have to sign. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to take a snapshot, so take a photo of everything that appears on potentially Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, anything we can get our hands on. We started with Twitter because the data is public. So once a URL, so a web link, is tweeted, we take a photo of, we save that page as a PDF just to make it simpler. So take a high fidelity a snapshot of the web link. The reason we do that is because we've been doing this now for a while, and we think that about 10% of the entire discussion on social platforms disappear very fast, shortly after the election cycle or the referendum, whatever it is that it's at stake. Once it's decided, 10% of it vanishes, and we want to take a look at it. So Facebook was kind enough to work with Social Science One. The initiative is spearheaded by Gary and Nate, and they were promising to give us basically a full-on data set of links that circulated on Facebook and that achieved a given threshold of traction. So say, I think last I heard was above 10 shares or 100 shares, whatever, were relatively popular. So that would be very helpful because that would allow us to take a look at the type of content that was potentially artificially pushed. So they might have been shared by accounts that were false, or they might have been advertised using Facebook's advertisement platform, which is quite sophisticated. If you have taken a look at it, it's amazing. And the content disappears. So we want to know what that is, because we know now, based on what we learned from 2016, both in the U.S. and Britain, that disinformation campaigns, they're very good at two things. First, because of the relatively low quality of the content, they are very good at pushing it fast, so it doesn't take forever to craft a piece of this information. Second, they are also very good at taking it out of the platform, taking it out of the internet, once it serves its purpose. And as a researcher, we need to take a comprehensive look at this information to basically to understand what's going on. And we can rely to an extent on the platforms, but there's a little bit that we might have to do ourselves.
Mm. Well, all right, folks, that's what's going on in terms of the cutting edge of platform research. And Dr. Bastos, we have a conference to attend early tomorrow morning. So thank you so much for taking the time out and coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here, Michael.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Marco Bastos, Senior Lecturer in Media and Communications at City, University of London. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you learned something. Join us next time, where I'll be interviewing Dr. Dan Mercha from City University of London and Dr. Sean Walker from Arizona State University, where we'll be talking about some of the challenges in terms of data and ethics around doing social media research, particularly in the context of protests and activism. Until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.